I'm reading from the NIV. Your version might be slightly different, but don't worry, because I'm not going to be too worried about differences of individual words. What I am concerned about, as I've already indicated, is to get away from the image that I have about the wise men visiting Jesus. You know, the standard crib scene, there are the shepherds, there's the star over the stable, and it's usually shown as a stable, a wooden building separate from a house, and there's the three kings with their gifts in their hands. When you read, or when you hear me read this, you'll notice that, first of all, it's not a stable, it's a house where Jesus is. He's no longer a baby, he's an infant. We think it's about 1 year to 2 years after birth. The shepherds aren't there. When the shepherds were there, there wasn't a stable over the building. And it's hard to put the mental image out of your mind, but try and do that if you would. So, starting at verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star in the east and have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied, "for this is what the prophet has written, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least amongst the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel.'" Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. If we were to read on, we'll see that Herod plans hadn't been planning to worship Jesus. He'd been planning to kill him. And he orders a decree that all children of the age of 2 and below are killed. Oh, sorry, all male children in the area are killed. But Mary, Joseph, and the child Jesus escapes to Egypt. So that's the reading that I'm going to be speaking on. But as I say, please put from your minds the traditional image of the crib, if you would, please. Right. I have a bit of music to play to you on the computer, except you're in for a rare treat. My computer doesn't seem to be able to play the first 20 seconds of this piece of music very well. So you're going to have a performance by me on the piano. Now, I know what you're thinking. 40 years ago, roughly, Eric Morecambe was able to claim that he had the right notes, not necessarily in the right order. I promise you, I've been practicing, I've had to practice this morning, these will be in the right order. I'll reveal all after I've finished the service. I will tell you what it's to do with it. But what was the image which came to your mind with that piece of music?
2001 Space Odyssey.
Yeah, you can tell people of a certain generation. 2001 Space Odyssey, I think it's the opening scene. And it's... Sorry? Yeah, I haven't seen Barbie. For some reason, I haven't seen Barbie. It's also was used as the theme music or the opening music for the BBC's coverage of the Apollo landing on the moon. It was also used by Elvis Presley as his fanfare music, for want of a phrase. Now, don't worry, I'm not going to start playing that every time I speak. I don't deserve a fanfare. It's called Thus Spake, or also Spake, Zarathustra, written by Richard Strauss in 1870s, if my memory is correct. And it's actually the sunrise element. And if you have that picture, you'll see that the composer intended you to think about a sunrise. Those are all red herrings as to what it's to do with the bit I'm talking about today. So let's go back to the, if I can, back to the PowerPoint. Herod the Great is actually fundamental to this story. I think his role in it is often overlooked. And I thought, well, you know, what do we know about Herod the Great? I've actually done a bit of research into him. He was Jewish. Now, you'll notice I've put that in speech marks. Two generations before him, his ancestors were in effect forced to adopt the Jewish religion. They never were devout Jews. They did it to save their lives. But he was handy from the Roman point of view because he could rule over Judea as a, for want of a phrase, as a figurehead, a Jewish figurehead. He was appointed to the role by the Senate in Rome in 37 BC, if my memory is correct. And he did stay there for a long in position for quite some time, for nearly 40 years. He was known for various things. He had building projects. He built a marina, a great big harbour, which benefited trade. I think that was in Caesarea. You might know him, of course, as the architect of the temple, of the second temple, so-called Herod's Temple. And that might make you think that he was doing something good for the Jews. And, of course, that was good. They'd had their temple rebuilt. But the Roman influence was there. Over the temple entrance was a golden eagle, in effect a reminder to everyone who came into the temple that it was actually Rome that was in charge, not God. And I think I'm right in saying that it was around about the time of the birth of Christ that there was a bit of a riot and the eagle was taken down and destroyed, and a great many lives were shed by the Romans because of that uprising. So, was this just a publicity stunt by him? He seemed to be very good at trying to spin things so that people would think of him in a good light. Unfortunately, his life wasn't a good example, to put it mildly. He was guilty of great cruelty. You'll notice I put there Henry VIII. His first wife he had a child with. He killed that child, and he exiled his wife, in effect divorced her. His mother-in-law gave him an alibi for the death of the child, but then said that her son-in-law shouldn't rule because he was basically of not sound mind, which makes me question how sound her mind is, because guess what happened to her? She was killed on the orders of Herod. He married again. He ended up killing that wife and their two children. He was capable of great cruelty. And as I say, that, in my mind, I thought, It's the Judean version of Henry VIII. So that's who Herod was. But he's actually very important in this story because of something which I'll come on to in a minute. Who are magi? Who were they? Well, they're priests, and notice I've emphasized they're not specifically kings. There's a prophecy, I'm not going to turn to it, in Isaiah chapter 60, verse 3, that says that kings will come to him. In fact, I will turn to it. It's only one verse. Isaiah chapter 60, verse 3. Nations will come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your dawn. And it is often interpreted as kings in fulfillment of that prophecy. You've got to fight against this because it's not there in the scripture. And if it had been kings fulfilling that prophecy, you can guarantee Matthew would have spelt it out. They were magi. Now, magi were priests from the particular religion. They'd come from the area which we now know as Iran or Afghanistan, we believe. It's not three of them. The early church, and the Coptics still hold to this tradition, actually have 12 kings, in inverted commas, coming. Probably to reflect the 12 tribes of Israel, I don't know. In our carol and Victorian traditions, we have three kings. I don't know if you've noticed, but one of them is African, one of them is Indian. The idea being that Jesus came to the whole world, and the whole world were represented in the kings that came to Jesus. But again, that is not in the scripture. But that's just to explain where the idea of three kings of different races comes from. They were from the Zoroaster religion. They were priests. The Magi were priests from that religion. It was the Persian Empire. They were very influential. And you'll see there, I've put down, thus spake Zarathustra. I've forgotten I'd put it there. The reason why that piece of music is relevant is because Zarathustra was the founder of the Zoroaster religion. And the piece of music was based on a fictionalized novel which was based on some of the teachings of Zoroaster, otherwise known as Zarathustra. So these were priests from a different religion, which makes it quite surprising that they come to worship Jesus. Their religion was based very heavily on knowledge. They were quite advanced at the time, so advanced that in history they went down as almost wizards. Indeed, our word magic comes from magi. It's the same root. They were very highly regarded. Now, when you think who else had been, or who had been there much closer to the birth of Jesus, we think of the shepherds. They were considered to be the lowest of society, Jews, not trustworthy, you know, not just working class, but the lowest of the low. I like the fact that God had shepherds being the first people that the angels told that the Son of God had been born. It's also interesting that at that same time, God gives a sign in the heavens to the Magi that the King of the Jews has been born. Why would he do that? Well, as I say, I think the Magi represented sinners. If you turn back to Deuteronomy, it's only one verse, so there's probably no need to it. This is just one of the verses I could have chosen. Chapter 18, verse 10, is a warning. Let no one be found among you who sacrifices his son or daughter in the fire, who practices divination or sorcery, interprets omens, engages in witchcraft or casts spells, interprets omens. Astrology. Difference between astrology and astronomy in those days was very slight. God put a sign in the heavens so that this non-Jewish pagan religion, if I can use that phrase, would come to worship his son. And that speaks of us. We are non-Jewish, or many of us are non-Jewish. We're from a different country, a different land. And those magi, and we are sinners. And those magi, to my mind, represents us. Present there with the young child Christ. And I love the fact that we are represented there. The importance who was not there. Okay, we've had the shepherds. We've got the Gentiles, the followers of a different religion who came to worship him. Who was not there? Now, often who is not there is as important as who is there. In one of Conan Doyle's books about Sherlock Holmes, stories about Sherlock Holmes, I think it was the one involving the horse that goes missing. Sherlock Holmes, the great detective, places great emphasis on the dog that didn't bark. In the criminal law, I was taught early on, look out for the evidence which isn't there, not just the evidence which is. Why didn't the dog bark? The dog didn't bark because it knew the person who stole the horse. Something was missing. Who's missing from celebrating the birth of the infant Jesus, or the baby Jesus, or the child Jesus? And it's the high priests, or anyone from the priests of the temple. Where are they in the nativity narration? They are not there until Jesus is taken to the temple. But they don't come and seek Jesus out. Why is that? Well, in researching Herod, I found out that he had sacked all the members of the tribe of Levi who were the priests in the temple and had appointed his own. In other words, priests who were sympathetic to the Roman invasion, sympathetic to the Romans. My mind then went to various places in the world where, for example, Putin has appointed people to the church who are his supporters, not necessarily the ones who would be best for the for Christianity. Herod appointed the priests. They are absent. They are not celebrating the birth of God's Son. When you think about it, that's quite something, because you would have expected them to be the first to be told. Indeed, of course, the Magi go to Jerusalem, the capital, and start asking about where is the newborn son who is born king of the Jews. And in the reading, you notice that Herod was greatly, and all the people were greatly troubled by this. One thing I haven't told you about Herod is when he was appointed, he was given a title. And the title was King of the Jews. That was given to him by the Senate in 37 BC. So suddenly Herod is being told by these wise men, the Magi, these knowledgeable people from the east, from a foreign land, that a babe has been born who is the true born King of the Jews, not an appointed one, the child who was born King of the Jews. And you can see in that now why he reacts the way he does. He wants to find out where the babe is so that he can kill him. After all, he's already killed off his sons who were presenting a danger to his throne. That often happens in history, I understand. And I'm not just talking about King Richard and possibly killing the princes in the tower. But that's what Herod had already done. Killed off his successors because they posed a rivalry to him. They could have led a revolution or been used as a figurehead for a revolution. He wanted to hold on to power. And so the birth of someone born the King of the Jews was greatly troubling to him. No wonder he was worried and concerned. Actually, before I come on to gifts, can I just mention the star? People have, throughout history, tried to work out what the star that the Magi saw was. What the star was that led them to the house where Jesus was. The star, which is often incorrectly shown as being over a stable. Various experts have come up with a conjunction of planets. I think the prime one is Mars, Saturn and Jupiter. They converge and others, they come so close together in the sky that they appear to be one bright star. That could be an explanation. It could be that it was a comet or two comets. One comet announcing the birth and another comet, perhaps with its tail, indicating which building Jesus was in. But don't go down that line. It's tempting to, and I've done it myself time and time again in the past. Accept it that it's a miracle from God. It could have been the equivalent of the fiery, cloudy pillar that the Israelites followed when they were on the Exodus. It could have been an angel. Certainly, as far as I'm concerned, and I'm not an expert on astronomy or astrology, as far as I'm concerned, no star could lead you to a particular building. So let's just accept it that it's God putting a sign in the skies for the Magi. A sign which they interpreted based on their teaching, on their understanding, as the fantastic news that the king of the Jews had been born. They got it right. The priests were totally oblivious to it. They got it right. And I like the fact that they are warned by God in a dream, and so they don't go back and tell Herod where Jesus is, because that would have killed Jesus. He would have killed Jesus immediately. Herod, realizing he's been tricked, issues a decree that children, all male children of 2 years and under, are to be killed in the area. I don't know how big the area was, but again, God warns Joseph and Mary and they flee to Egypt. Jesus was a stranger in Bethlehem and he's now a refugee on that. The traditional Carol of We Three Kings, written, I think it was in 1850, if my memory is correct, plays great emphasis on the gifts given by the Magi. Gifts of gold, frankincense, in the NIV translated more accurately as incense, and myrrh. And the carol does get one thing right. You can attribute certain meanings to the gifts given. This doesn't mean, I don't think, that the wise men knew the future of Jesus. If they were that schooled in the Old Testament writings, they would have known that Jesus was going to be born in Bethlehem. I think, again, it's just God organising things so that we can look back on it and say, yeah, I see what you did there, God. Now, in the carol, they've got three very distinct applications, the three gifts. Gold, of course, represents royalty. I don't know if you know, but if you start digging in your garden at home and you suddenly come across a seam of gold ore, it's not yours. Sorry to disappoint you on that, though the chances of it are very remote. If you find gold in gold ore form in your garden, it is not yours. It belongs to the crown. And you'd have to get a license from the crown, in other words, the government, to mine it. And you can guarantee that very little profit of it would come to you. But gold in these times clearly represented royalty. Gold for a crown. Frankincense or incense, used in worship. That is still used, incense is used, although it's not true frankincense. I understand the Catholic Church use a much cheaper form of incense. And it's still used, it's often used to represent the prayers of the devout going up to God. So it represents prayer and again perhaps a reflection of God's deity, of Jesus' deity. Myrrh. the embalming spice, thinking of death. As I say, it's used in embalming. But I'd like to show you three other ways in which those gifts reflects Jesus more accurately, or more completely, I should say. Gold. Now, I'm not a scientist, but I remember learning at school the periodical table. Metals are funny things. Lithium, that stuff which you put in a car, if you've got an electric car battery, if you drop lithium in water, it bursts into flame. Very unstable, which is why if your electric car catches fire, there are major problems, because all the energy that's contained in the car battery, that's an electric car, all that energy comes out as heat, which is why the fires are so difficult to put out. You can't just put water on them. Water is what makes lithium burn. But gold is the opposite end of the metal spectrum. Gold doesn't react, I was going to say, with anything. I think there is one acid which will attack gold, and it's a mixture of acids. But it doesn't tarnish. It's incorruptible. I remember years ago seeing Tony Robinson and the Time team. They were digging a castle. I can't remember where it was. One of the people digging out the moat, which was filled in, suddenly came across a gold coin about that diameter, and his hand was shaking. And he described how he just scraped away, and there it was, gleaming at him. Gold which had been in the ground for centuries. If that was copper, bronze, silver, or anything, it'd be very, very tarnished. Gold is untouched. To use the old-fashioned word, it's incorruptible. That, to me, speaks about Jesus, born human in every way except one. He was untarnished. He was pure. He did not sin. And so the gold, to me, speaks more about Jesus' purity, the fact that he was perfect, not like the rest of us. Frankincense. Apparently, it was used to treat diabetes at the time of Jesus. Of course, it didn't actually treat diabetes. It actually modified or reduced some of the symptoms. But frankincense was believed to have incredible healing powers, taken for a range of things, a bit like mercury was in the 17th century. Frankincense was the cure-all. And when I read that, I thought, yes, and Jesus, the great healer, yes, healing the lame, giving sight to the blind, even healing the dead by raising them. And it's that latter attribute, which I want to think about. Jesus, he's my healer. He healed me from my sin. He has given me eternal life, and he's given it to you as well. So that's what frankincense says to me. What about myrrh? It was actually used in purification, and it actually features in the Old Testament. I won't turn to it, but in Exodus chapter 10, it's one of the ingredients in a mixture of fragrant spices, which was used purely for God, purely to purify the sacrifice for God. It makes clean, and that, of course, speaks to me of my Saviour, who made me clean. He cleansed me from my sin. Doesn't mean that I'm sinless, doesn't mean that I'm perfect, but he cleansed me from my sin. And so that's three different things that I'd like you to think of when you hear about the three gifts of the Magi, of the wise men. And it all speaks to Jesus' sacrifice on the cross at Calvary. The perfect sacrifice, the sinless one, paying the price for what I've done wrong, for what you've done wrong. That's just wonderful. The fact that he does cleanse us, he does heal us. I think that's tremendous. And that's what I want you to take away from the story of the Magi today. Jesus on the cross at Calvary fulfilled those other meanings of the three types of gift that Jesus was given.